Today's Teisho is case 58 in the Haikigan Roku, the Blue Rock Collection. Joshu's No Justification. Main subject, a monk said to Joshu, "You so often quote the words, 'The great way is not difficult. It only abhors choice and attachment.' Isn't that your point of attachment?" Joshu said, "A man asked me the same question once before, and 5 years later, I still have found no justification for it." Setcho's verse, "King elephants yawn, king lions roar. Plain words stop men's mouths. North, east, south, and west, the crow swoops, the hare bounds." Well, this is the first day of our winter 2006 session, and I want to thank everybody for excellent sitting this morning. It was really wonderful in the Zendo this morning. It's really exciting to me that everybody is here and practicing, and practicing so well. It's really just working today, cleaning up the Zendo, preparing the meal. It's wonderful to see you all. It's wonderful to practice with all of you. And I'm tremendously happy we could all be together. The main figure in this koan is Master Joshu. Let me just, some of you are quite familiar with this story and some of you aren't so familiar, but Joshu was a rather unusual person. He began doing meditation. He began doing sesshin, just like us. He began doing sesshin when he was about 15 or 16 years old. Some of you are not that far away from 15 or 16. Maybe 6 or 7 years. I'm always impressed by people who are so young who are able to do this. Generally, it takes a certain amount of life experience and a certain amount of maturity to see the value of what we're doing, or at least to feel the desire to do what we're doing. That might be a better way to put it. It's unusual to have 16-year-old people show up in Zendo anywhere, in my experience. And it's unusual for them to stay, and it would be really unusual for them to come to sesshin. And we have a few members of our group who are quite young. We have a person who's come to a fair number of sesshin. He's not here this time, but he was a freshman when he came to his first sesshin. And he had started sitting that fall semester. He's a rather quiet guy. And he unobtrusively came into the Zendo. And at the end of the semester, he came up to me and he very quietly said, "I think I'd like to go to sesshin." And I actually tried to discourage him. I said, "Well, why don't you wait, you know, another semester?" And he said, "No, I really want to go." So he went. And as I say, he's been to a number of sesshin over the years. And that's so unusual. So Joshu was 16. He began to practice meditation. And he had, at a local temple, and he had a Kensho experience, very powerful Kensho experience. Years later, when he tried to describe that experience, he said, remember, this is Zen talk. somebody asked him to describe it, he said it was like being ruined and left me ruined and alone. So in Zen talk, people don't always quite say what they mean. If they say somebody's a blockhead, they mean he's a wonderful person. And ruined and alone can mean a lot of different things. It can mean all my illusions were blown out the window and I had felt oneness with everything around me, which is, I think, what Joshua was getting at. Sometimes people come to Sesshin and they have a Kensho, and that's it. They say, okay, good enough. Now on to something else, right? Maybe Tai Chi, you know, maybe learn to play the piano. And some people say, wow, what is this all about? What was that? I just got hit by a truck. What was that truck? And Joshua was one of the latter kind of people. So he had this Kensho experience, and he said, wow, is there anything more like that back there somewhere? And then he heard about a teacher named Nansen, Master Nansen. And he went to study with Nansen. And Nansen and Joshu became legendary in the Tang Dynasty. They were great practitioners of Zen, so to speak. In other words, they really loved to do what we're here today doing. And they loved doing it with each other. And it was the best darn thing in the world. Just like it here. And they liked it so much, or they loved it so much, that they did it on and on and on and on until Nansen died. And so Joshu was a young man when he started practicing with Nansen, and he was an old man when Nansen died. And his friend, you know, Joshu had passed all his koans, he had finished his practice a long time before Nansen died. He could have gone on to another temple, but he really just wanted to stay with his friend and do this beautiful practice together, this beautiful path of Zen. You know, in life, you just run into people. And there's this idea of karmic compatibility, or karmic connection. It's a little nuts to try to figure it out, you know. You will meet people who will say, you know, I think I knew you in my previous life. And I really sincerely urge you not to go down that road. In fact, you know, the Buddha actually said, don't try to figure that stuff out. It's too complicated. Forget about it. But the point is, you know, sometimes you meet people that you like, right? You really hit it off, and you feel alive, and you feel this this wonderful Tathagata. Tathagata means a presence, right? The Buddha, Lord Buddha, was called Tathagata because he manifested the spirit of this the pure presentness of the moment. When people were with the Buddha, they felt very keenly the pure presence of the moment. And it was a very powerful experience for them. So they nicknamed him Tathagata. So sometimes you run into people and you like the Tathagata, right? It's just wonderful. And you enjoy their company. You don't know why, you just do. And this is a sort of karmic compatibility. And some people don't have it, you know? You meet people. I've met people, and, you know, I met a very famous Japanese teacher who was head of training at the Heiji Temple. And he had much more impressive credentials than my first teacher, Genki Roshi. But I don't know, he just left me cold. It was just, there just wasn't a connection there. In fact, I thought he was kind of irritating, to tell you the truth. And he was, and many people that way. But if there had been, you know, compatibility, it would have just been wonderful. So, anyway, Nansen and Joshu had this great friendship. You know, it really, teacher and student, this is just a temporary relationship, right? Because people finish their koans, and it was a real friendship, and dharma friendship. I think that sometimes the friendships people form on the cushion are the most profound relationships they have in this life. Because, you know, often we have motives in dealing with other people, but when we're practicing with somebody else, we really don't have any motives. In fact, more on this later. So Nansen and Joshu practiced for many years, and then Nansen inevitably, everybody dies, and Nansen died, and Joshu was told by everybody, it's time for you to become the head of the temple. And Joshu said, not so fast, you know, I'm only 65, and I'm a young man. I'd like to learn more about this beautiful path. And so he did something that was sort of unconventional. He hit the road. And in China at that time, it was not unconventional for monks and nuns to travel all over. China at that time was like a society built around enlightenment, like Tibet in more recent times. And our society, it's built around the making of money, right? I mean, that's just the way it is. America is dedicated to the making of wealth. But in China, they were dedicated to producing enlightened people. And all over China, there were what were called public temples, just like public high school. It was public temple. And any monk or nun of good character could travel all over the country and just stay. You had to pretend you had like a little credential, you know, and you presented it, and that you could stay at a temple and do sesshin. But it was unusual for a very senior person like Joshu to hit the road like a beginning monk or nun and present his little ID and go through the motions, just like a very humble person, right? He presented, just go to the temple, present himself at the temple. And of course, everybody in China knew who Joshu was. It would be like the Dalai Lama trying to pass himself off as an ordinary person. Everybody knows who the Dalai Lama is, so sort of like that. There are many koans that involve Joshu's going to various temples and encountering both great teachers and students as well. There are very few people who come off that well in exchanges with Joshu. One person who did was Wang Bo, and there's a few others. Generally speaking, the koans are about his exchanges with the students. And at this time, Joshu's reputation was rather great, and people were always probing, trying to see the condition of his mind, and sometimes there was a little bit of antagonism. You know, people sort of felt like, so, you're the great Joshu, eh? We'll see how great you are. And so sometimes the koans have that spirit of an exchange. So this is the period when Joshu was on the road after he was 65. He eventually went back to Nansen's temple and became the teacher there. But he was about 100 when that happened. He was in his 90s, actually. And he invented the Mu Koan, which we all use and which is the foundation of our practice. He invented that koan when he was about 100 years old. So a monk said to Joshu, "You so often quote the words, 'The great way is not difficult for those who have no preferences.' Isn't that your own preference?" It's just like, aha, you know, caught you. Joshu said, "You know, somebody asked me that question years ago, and I still have, there's still no justification for it." That's his answer. And so the koan is, no justification. No. So if you were going to do this koan, you would just sit on the cushion, straighten your back, begin to breathe through from the dantian, ahara, and you would say, no justification. No. Or maybe one breath, no, one breath, justification, one breath, no, one breath, justification. So that's the koan. This is earlier than Mu, but a great koan. You know, when we come to a session, we think we have motives. We think we have motives. So it's possible that you came here because you are somewhat troubled in your life. And if that's the case, I'm so glad you're here. This practice can be like a recuperating period. Even though we're going to only get about 5.5 hours of sleep, and we're going to be sitting motionless for many hours a day, it's actually a wonderful opportunity to recuperate from all the stresses and strains. Now, when you leave here, if you practice wholeheartedly, you will be so relaxed and calm, and your mind will be so clear and bright. And I've seen that again and again. You know, people will come to Sesshin, and they're careworn, right? Defeats, challenges, tensions, stresses, disappointments. And you go through this process, and it's like becoming a little baby again. So, you know, at the end of Sesshin even, you can see in people's faces the kind of the gentling of their faces. So that's a good motive. If you're coming to escape from your suffering or to get a little break from the boxing match of life, you know, this is really a wonderful place to come. You may be coming here to refuel. You know, a lot of times we have trouble maintaining our energy level or our morale. So Sesshin can be like putting a fresh battery in your car. Right? You can come to Sesshin and you can open the doors of perception. And your floodgates of creativity can be open. And that's a wonderful opportunity. Many creative people use a sesshin to do this. Last year, at the winter sesshin, an artist came, and one of the things he said was that he had been sort of stuck before the sesshin. But all through the sesshin, he filled his sketchbooks with ideas. And if you sit quietly and with your whole heart, you know, those doors will open and all of this beautiful life energy will flow into your body. So that's a good reason to come. And there are other reasons too. You may want to answer your koan. And that's a little trickier as a motivation, however, because you know, the more you try to answer your koan, the more tension you put on yourself. You know, people who are just trying to get out of pain and just trying to escape from unhappiness just have to go sort of through the process, and pretty much if that's all they want, this will probably work out for them. And if not, you know, we'll see their car driving away around day three, which sometimes happens. But wanting to answer your koan is a little bit different because in that case you have big expectations, right? Big expectations. And then that can actually be an obstacle. The point I want to make is that we come to Sesshin with, we think we come to Sesshin with motivation or reasons or purposes, right? But I'd like to suggest that the Zen life is not about purposes or reasons at all, and that the reasons you're giving aren't the reasons you're really here. Actually, if you walk this path long enough, you will stop doing things for any reason whatsoever. This is Joshu's point. If you walk this path long enough, you'll stop doing this for any reason whatsoever. Any reason whatsoever. And really, I think reasons are not very important. See, we think we're doing something for certain reasons, but that's not really so. Now, I was reading this this article in the paper the other day, and it was just fascinating to me, and I saved it because it was so relevant to what we're doing here. But it was an article on psychology, how children learn. You know, I'm an English teacher, so I'm very interested in various aspects of learning. And it was a New York Times article on December the 13th. And the title is, Children Learn by Monkey See, Monkey Do, Chimps Don't. So that, of course, got my attention right away. And the articles are really interesting. Some psychologists did a study, and they created a box. It was a black box, plexiglass that had been spray painted black. And they put a banana in the box. So you have a monkey, and you show the monkey the box, and you show the banana going into the box. Then you close the box up, and then you show the monkey how to open the box. So what you have to do is you have to push some knobs on the side, and then you lift the top up, and then you take out the banana. Okay, that's all you would have to do. But the researchers introduced some extra steps. So basically, you don't just push the knobs on the side and lift the top of the box up. They knocked on the top of the box and maybe moved it completely around or something like that. Then they lifted the knobs up and opened the box. Okay. So then, having demonstrated this to the monkey, they gave it to the monkey, and the monkey did exactly what the human did to get the banana. He knocked on the top, turned it around, depressed the buttons, and lifted the top and ate the banana with much happiness. Okay. So then they did the same experiment with a little baby boy. Okay. And guess what? The baby boy did the same thing. He imitated the behavior of the person demonstrating how to get the banana. So he knocked on the top, turned the box around, put his fingers on the knobs and lifted the top and ate the banana just as happily as the monkey. Okay. Well, they didn't really say that. Who doesn't like bananas? So now, the interesting, that's part one of the experiment. If both monkey and human imitate the psychologist who teaches them how to open the box. Okay, now they have another plexiglass box, but guess what? It's clear. Okay? And you can see the banana, and you can see how to open the box, okay? So the psychologist comes in with the monkey and shows the monkey, takes the monkey through the usual steps, knocking on the top, turning the box around, pressing the sides and lifting up. Okay. Does that for the monkey and does that for the child. This is with the clear box. Now the interesting thing is the monkey can see, I don't have to knock on the top, I can just open it up, right? And guess what? The monkey just opens the box because the monkey can see at a glance how the box really works. See? Now the interesting part of the experiment is this, that even though the baby boy, the little boy, can see just what the monkey sees, he still goes through the procedure he was taught. See, I think that's fascinating. In other words, we're more imitative than monkeys. Right? See? And the article is so interesting because it actually gloats. It says, well, what do you know? You know, monkeys are stupider than we thought, or something like that. But actually, the conclusion it should have reached is the very opposite. You know, the monkey is able to size up the situation and go around the instructions given by the psychologist. But human beings have such a powerful imitative faculty. Our learning process is linked so much to the approval of others that this little boy, this little child, wasn't able to just go in and get the banana, even though it was right there in plain view. So the conclusion I would draw is the monkey is smarter. You know, this is like our glory, right, and our curse. Our glory and our curse. Because all of our lives, we're trying to do what we have been told is the right thing to do, instead of acting out of our true nature. For the monkey, it's no problem, right? I mean, let's face it, imitation is a wonderful thing, right? Imitation is a wonderful thing. One human's walking down the street and sees another human. He's got a box with a hole in the front of the box, and there's a long neck, and there's some strings on it. He's plucking the strings. He says, what's that? I just made it. It's a guitar. Cool. How do you do it? You know, this is the glory of humans. But the problem is that we live very deadened lives because we're always trying to follow the instructions we've been given by others. So, it's very, very hard for human beings to act naturally, to be alive naturally. And the truth is the way of Zen is having no reasons. See, there's a different way to live, which is to draw your energy, draw your instructions from true nature, your true nature. This is a spontaneous life. And this is what Zen practice is all about. If you're going through a sesshin, and if this is your first sesshin, it's a little scary, and it's going to be difficult. And at times, you may have reasons for staying and reasons for going. But don't believe any of them. Your motives are deeper. They come from a deeper source. You know, I've talked about this person before. My sister-in-law is a painter, and she's a fantastic painter. In our living room, we have a painting she did of two geese, and it's so powerful. It's just beautiful. And she's done many things like that that are just that. When I look at the, my heart just leaps up when I look at these paintings that she's done. And she hasn't really made any money. You know, so many times she's had shows where She's brought out this wonderful work, and you know, maybe somebody will buy it and somebody doesn't buy it. And I know she's had a rough life. Her name is Sydney. Sydney is something. And her brother, John, is also, many people in my wife's family are artists. Her brother started out as a sculptor, but he just couldn't take the psychological weight of not being approved. You know, so he actually now makes high-end custom furniture. And it's really high-end, like $30,000 bookcase and things like that. And so, you know, he has wealthy clients, and he gets architectural commissions. And Sydney is a social worker in Albuquerque and paints at night. You know, I've often asked her about her life, and she said, you know, I wouldn't trade a thing. And this is the life I wanted to lead. And when I paint, I just feel totally alive. It's interesting, also, I was reading years ago an interview with Georgia O'Keeffe, and this interviewer said, how does it feel to be the most famous painter, American painter of the 20th century? She said, I don't care. I don't care at all. She said, in fact, it's absurd because I've known many better artists than I. And she said, I know artists who are much better than I, and you've never even heard of them. She said, that's not why I did this. I did this because I had no choice. See, that's the way to live. See, that's the way to live. Or that's the Zen way to live. And no justification. Sometimes you do something even though you know it's crazy because you have to do it. Right? You have to do it. Your true self says do it. And you know, it is true, sometimes, you think, why am I doing this? You know, what has my true self done to me? You know, why didn't it, you know, tell me the lottery numbers or the winning lottery numbers? Why is it doing this? And I must say, I've had many times in life where, you know, I have thought to myself, what the heck? But I'm so, when I am true to my true nature, I'm so happy, even if I fail. See, that's the interesting thing. Even when I fail, if I feel alive, that sense of aliveness, you know, that sense of connection to the universe, and everybody knows that, you know, when it happens. You know, maybe it's playing the guitar for you, or maybe it's writing poetry, or maybe it's Tai Chi, or maybe it's working in your lab. You know, I myself write things that are very boring, actually, probably, for most people. But, you know, when I'm writing them, I feel so alive. And I guess, you know, it doesn't matter, really, that not many people are going to read it, or so it's pretty boring. You know, but when I just feel like the universe is flowing through my fingers as I'm, you know, typing. And that's what Zen is all about, living that kind of, that no justification life. And at any rate, I don't trust reasons. I really don't. I think a lot of the time we just make up reasons after the fact anyway. I think real spontaneous life doesn't require reasons. You get your orders from your true nature. And you come to Sesshin, and maybe you have pain in your legs the whole time, but you're being true to your true nature. This is the essence of the Zen life. And as life unfolds, you know, you discover who you really are when you're true. You know who you really are. You see your true, it's true nature, right? You discover who you really are. As you go through this process, a difficult process of being true to your true nature, but this eventually you see yourself face to face. This is what we call Daikensho. So answering koan is not so important. And reasons are really, we have kind of like haunted minds. I myself have had a bit of a cold the last few days. And when I get sick, I don't know about you, but when I get sick, I sometimes have like hallucinatory dreams, like insane dreams. I don't know if that happens to you. But it's like, last night I had one of these, like, when I'm sick, I get these like crazy dreams where all night long, I think I was rolling back and forth on the bed, and in my mind, my conscious mind kept thinking, I've got to count them, I've got to count them, and I've got to count them, you know. And I would wake up and think, count what? You know, what? You know. But at another level, my mind said, I've got to count, I've got to get the count, I've got to count, you know. Maybe I'm the only one. But this happens to me when I get, it's like these strange problems that I'm trying to solve when I'm sick. You know? And I woke up and it's like, there isn't anything to count. You know? Go back to sleep. I think Zen is like that. You know, what we call ordinary life, it really and truly is a kind of collective dream. And it's not a benign dream. It's full of baloney. It's got many destructive elements. And it's like, in some ways, there are wonderful things about the collective dream that we've created. You know, Cezanne, you know, Mozart, Bruce Springsteen. I love Bruce Springsteen. Those are the good side of the collective dream. But beware, right? Because all this destructive elements too that are unfolding all the time, you know, to everybody's amazement. Put a little. I think that people like Bruce Springsteen didn't really create his beautiful music by trying to be like somebody else, right? And in fact, you know, I saw this photo of Bruce Springsteen the other day when he was starting to play in Asbury Park, when he was just a kid, really. You know, he had no guarantees, right? He didn't, you know, when people write biographies, they say, little did he know he would become Mozart, you know, little. But it's never like that. It's always so false. It's always a crapshoot, right? So, you know, Bruce Springsteen and the E Street Band could have been, Bruce Springsteen could be working in a bowling alley today, you know, really. There's no guarantees in life. He could be a social worker, like my sister-in-law. And every once in a while, he could go home, or maybe he and his band would get together and they'd do gigs in New Jersey. You know, that could have happened. There's no guarantees, but I don't think his beautiful music came into existence because he worried about that. In fact, the more you worry about that, the less likely it is that something good is going to happen. You just have to be in the flow. You just have to be true to your true nature and just follow it and see. It's like opening a box. You know, life is like a box, right? You get this beautiful present. And people get the president, they think, well, am I going to be president of the United States? Will I be a great genius? And then they open the box and think, well, this is not the president I wanted. You know, that's a formula for unhappiness in life or at sesshin. So the Zen approach is whatever is in this box, this is the adventure of my life. And something brought me here. I don't know what my true nature brought me here. And I'm going to go with this feeling, and I don't know where it's going to take me, but I feel so alive. And if somebody said, why did you come here? Even saying true nature, see, my true nature brought me here, that's also a justification. You know when you feel alive. You know when you feel this joy, you know? And it can be in the middle of your legs killing you. But somehow you feel that connection. You know, when things come alive, it's not always easy to be alive. It's hard. It's not always painless to be alive. You know, it's much easier to be sort of anesthetized. But But when you're engaging with life and that you feel that sense of connection, you don't need a justification. See, that's the Zen life. That's what Sesshin is all about. So whatever your motives for coming here, there's nothing wrong with having motives. And so if you came here to get away from your suffering, you know, I'm sure you'll be successful if you just practice wholeheartedly. If you came here to open the floodgates of creativity, wonderful. Let them open. If you came here to answer your koan, it may happen and it may not, you know, but it's always wonderful to be true to your true nature. Something told you to come here. And so the practice takes on a whole different dimension. Right? It's not about taking. It's not about what's in it for me. It's like, I love this beautiful life. It's like everything you do becomes like giving, giving, giving. A monk said to Joshu, "You so often quote the words, 'The great way is not difficult for those who have no preferences.' Isn't that your preference?" Joshu said, "A man asked me that same question once before, and 5 years later I still have no justifications. I don't live that way." Secho's verse, "King elephants yawn, king lions roar, plain words stop men's mouths. North, south, east, and west, the crow swoops, the hare bounds." See, they don't have justification. Just natural life. This is learning how to be natural, or unlearning is what this is all about. So welcome to Sesshin. Welcome to day one of Sesshin. Let's practice. No justification. Practice with no justification.